This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Brooklyn by Cullum Tobin. For Peter Strauss. Part 1. Eilish Lacey, sitting at the window of the upstairs living room in the house on Frary Street, noticed her sister walking briskly from work. She watched Rose crossing the street from sunlight into shade, carrying the new leather handbag that she had bought in Clary's in Dublin in the sale. Rose was wearing a cream-colored cardigan over her shoulders. Her golf clubs were in the hall. In a few minutes, Eilish knew, someone would call for her, and her sister would not return until the summer evening had faded. Eilish's bookkeeping classes were almost ended now. She had a manual on her lap about systems of accounting, and on the table behind her was a ledger where she had entered, as her homework on the debit and credit sides, the daily business of a company whose details she had taken down in notes in the vocational school the week before. As soon as she heard the front door open, Eilish went downstairs. Rose, in the hall, was holding her pocket mirror in front of her face. She was studying herself closely as she applied lipstick and eye makeup, before glancing at her overall appearance in the large hall mirror, settling her hair. Eilish looked on silently as her sister moistened her lips, and then checked herself one more time in the pocket mirror before putting it away. Their mother came from the kitchen to the hall. "You look lovely, Rose," she said. "You'll be the belle of the golf club." "I'm starving," Rose said, "but I've no time to eat." "I'll make a special tea for you later," her mother said. "Eilish and myself are going to have our tea now." Rose reached into her handbag and took out her purse. She placed a 1 shilling piece on the hall stand. "That's in case you want to go to the pictures," she said to Eilish.
"And what about me?" her mother asked.
"She'll tell you the whole story when she gets home," Rose replied.
"That's a nice thing to say," her mother said.
All three laughed as they heard a car stop outside the door and beep its horn. Rose picked up her golf clubs and was gone. Later, as her mother washed the dishes and Eilish dried them, another knock came to the door. When Eilish answered it, she found a girl whom she recognized from Kelly's grocery shop beside the cathedral.
"Miss Kelly sent me with a message for you," the girl said. "She wants to see you."
"Does she?"
Eilish asked.
"And did she say what it was about?"
"No, you're just to call up there tonight."
"But why does she want to see me?"
"God, I don't know, miss. I didn't ask her. Do you want me to go back and ask her?"
"No, it's all right. But are you sure the message is for me?"
"I am, miss. She says you are to call in on her."
Since she had decided in any case to go to the pictures some other evening, and being tired of her ledger, Eilish changed her dress and put on a cardigan and left the house. She walked along Frary Street and Rafter Street into the Market Square and then up the hill to the cathedral. Miss Kelly's shop was closed, so Eilish knocked on the side door, which led to the upstairs part where she knew Miss Kelly lived. The door was answered by the young girl who had come to the house earlier, who told her to wait in the hall. Eilish could hear voices and movement on the floor above, and then the young girl came down and said that Miss Kelly would be with her before long. She knew Miss Kelly by sight, but her mother did not deal in her shop as it was too expensive. Also, she believed that her mother did not like Miss Kelly, although she could think of no reason for this. It was said that Miss Kelly sold the best ham in the town, and the best creamery butter, and the freshest of everything, including cream, but Eilish did not think she had ever been in the shop, merely glanced into the interior as she passed and noticed Miss Kelly at the counter. Miss Kelly slowly came down the stairs into the hallway and turned on a light.
"Now," she said, and repeated it as though it were a greeting. She did not smile.
Eilish was about to explain that she had been sent for, and to ask politely if this was the right time to come, but Miss Kelly's way of looking her up and down made her decide to say nothing. Because of Miss Kelly's manner, Eilish wondered if she had been offended by someone in the town and had mistaken her for that person.
"Here you are, then," Miss Kelly said.
Eilish noticed a number of black umbrellas resting against the hall stand.
"I hear you have no job at all, but a great head for figures."
"Is that right?"
"Oh, the whole town.
anyone who is anyone comes into the shop, and I hear everything." Eilish wondered if this was a reference to her own mother's consistent dealing in another grocery shop, but she was not sure. Miss Kelly's thick glasses made the expression on her face difficult to read. "And we are worked off our feet every Sunday here. Sure, there's nothing else open. And we get all sorts, good, bad, and indifferent. And, as a rule, I open after 7 Mass, and between the end of 9 o'clock Mass until 11 Mass is well over, there isn't room to move in this shop. I have Mary here to help, but she's slow enough at the best of times, so I was on the lookout for someone sharp, someone who would know people and give the right change, but only on Sundays, mind. The rest of the week we can manage ourselves. And you were recommended. I made inquiries about you, and it would be 7 and 6 a week. It might help your mother a bit." Miss Kelly spoke, Eilish thought, as though she were describing a slight done to her, closing her mouth tightly between each phrase. "So that's all I have to say now. You can start on Sunday, but come in tomorrow and learn off all the prices, and we'll show you how to use the scales and the slicer. You'll have to tie your hair back and get a good shop coat in Dan Bolger's or Burke O'Leary's." Eilish was already saving this conversation for her mother and Rose. She wished she could think of something smart to say to Miss Kelly without being openly rude. Instead, she remained silent.
"Well?"
Miss Kelly asked. Eilish realized that she could not turn down the offer. It would be better than nothing, and, at the moment, she had nothing.
"Oh, yes, Miss Kelly," she said. "I'll start whenever you like."
"And on Sunday you can go to 7 o'clock Mass. That's what we do, and we open when it's over."
"That's lovely,"
Eilish said. "So come in tomorrow, then, and if I'm busy, I'll send you home. Or you can fill bags of sugar while you wait, but if I'm not busy, I'll show you all the ropes."
"Thank you, Miss Kelly," Eilish said.
"Your mother'll be pleased that you have something, and your sister,"
Miss Kelly said.
"I hear she's great at the golf. So go home now like a good girl. You can let yourself out."
Miss Kelly turned and began to walk slowly up the stairs. Eilish knew, as she made her way home, that her mother would indeed be happy that she had found some way of making money of her own, but that Rose would think working behind the counter of a grocery shop was not good enough for her. She wondered if Rose would say this to her directly. On her way home, she stopped at the house of her best friend, Nancy Byrne, to find that their friend Annette O'Brien was also there. The Burns had only one room downstairs, which served as a kitchen, dining room, and sitting room, and it was clear that Nancy had news of some sort to impart, some of which Annette seemed already to know. Nancy used Eilish's arrival as an excuse to go out for a walk so they could talk in confidence.
"Did something happen?"
Eilish asked once they were on the street.
"Say nothing until we are a mile away from that house," Nancy said. "Mammy knows there's something, but I'm not telling her."
They walked down Frary Hill and across the Mill Park Road to the river, and then down along the prom towards the Ringwood.
"She got off with George Sheridan,"
Annette said.
"When?"
Eilish asked.
"At the dance in the Athenaeum on Sunday night," Nancy said. "I thought you weren't going to go."
"I wasn't, and then I did."
"She danced all night with him," Annette said.
"I didn't, just the last 4 dances, and then he walked me home. But everybody saw. I'm surprised you haven't heard."
"And are you going to see him again?"
Eilish asked.
"I don't know,"
Nancy sighed.
"Maybe I'll just see him on the street. He drove by me yesterday and beeped the horn. If there had been anyone else there, I mean anyone of his sort, he would have danced with her. But there wasn't. He was with Jim Farrell, who just stood there looking at us."
"If his mother finds out, I don't know what she'll say," Annette said. "She's awful. I hate going into that shop when Jim isn't there. My mother set me down once to get 2 rashers, and that old one told me she didn't sell rashers in 2s.
Eilish then told them that she had been offered a job serving in Miss Kelly's every Sunday.
"I hope you told her what to do with it,"
Nancy said.
"I told her I'd take it. It won't do any harm. It means I might be able to go to the Athenaeum with you using my own money, and prevent you being taken advantage of."
"It wasn't like that,"
Nancy said.
"He was nice."
"Are you going to see him again?" Eilish repeated.
"Will you come with me on Sunday night?"
Nancy asked Eilish.
"He mightn't even be there, but Annette can't come, and I'm going to need support in case he is there and doesn't even ask me to dance or doesn't even look at me. I might be too tired from working for Miss Kelly. But you'll come?
I haven't been there for ages, Eilish said. I hate all those country fellows, and the town fellows are worse, half drunk and just looking to get you up the tan yard lane.
George isn't like that, Nancy said.
He's too stuck up to go near the tan yard lane, Annette said.
Maybe we'll ask him if he'd consider selling rashers in twos in the future, Eilish said.
Say nothing to him, Nancy said.
Are you really going to work for Miss Kelly?
There's a one for rashers.
Over the next 2 days, Miss Kelly took Eilish through every item in the shop. When Eilish asked for a piece of paper so she could note the different brands of tea and the various sizes of the packets, Miss Kelly told her that it would only waste time if she wrote things down. It was best instead to learn them off by heart. Cigarettes, butter, tea, bread, bottles of milk, packets of biscuits, cooked ham and corned beef were by far the most popular items sold on Sundays, she said, and after these came tins of sardines and salmon, tins of mandarin oranges and pears and fruit salad, jars of chicken and ham paste, and sandwich spread and salad cream. She showed Eilish a sample of each object before telling her the price. When she thought that Eilish had learned these prices, she went on to other items, such as cartons of fresh cream, bottles of lemonade, tomatoes, heads of lettuce, fresh fruit, and blocks of ice cream.
Now there are people who come in here on a Sunday, if you don't mind, looking for things they should get during the week. What can you do?
Miss Kelly pursed her lips disapprovingly as she listed soap, shampoo, toilet paper, and toothpaste, and called out the different prices. Some people, she added, also bought bags of sugar on a Sunday, or salt, and even pepper, but not many. And then there were even those who would look for golden syrup or baking soda or flour, but most of these items were sold on a Saturday. There were always children, Miss Kelly said, looking for bars of chocolate or toffee or bags of sherbet or jelly babies, and men looking for loose cigarettes and matches. But Mary would deal with those, since she was no good at large orders or remembering prices, and was often, Miss Kelly went on, more of a hindrance than a help when there was a big crowd in the shop.
I can't stop her gawking at people for no reason, even some of the regular customers.
The shop, Eilish saw, was well stocked, with many different brands of tea, some of them very expensive, and all of them at higher prices than Hayes Grocery in Frary Street, or the L&N in Rafter Street, or Sheridan's in the Market Square.
You'll have to learn how to pack sugar and wrap a loaf of bread, Miss Kelly said. Now that's one of the things that Mary is good at, God help her.
As each customer came into the shop on the days when she was being trained, Eilish noticed that Miss Kelly had a different tone. Sometimes she said nothing at all, merely clenched her jaw and stood behind the counter in a pose that suggested deep disapproval of the customer's presence in her shop and an impatience for that customer to go. For others, she smiled dryly and studied them with grim forbearance, taking the money as though offering an immense favor. And then there were customers whom she greeted warmly and by name. Many of these had accounts with her, and thus no cash changed hands, but amounts were noted in a ledger, with inquiries about health, and comments on the weather, and remarks on the quality of the ham, or the rashers, or the variety of the bread on display, from the batch loaves to the duck loaves to the currant bread.
"And I'm trying to teach this young lady,"
she said to a customer whom she seemed to value above all the rest, a woman with a fresh perm in her hair, whom Eilish had never seen before.
"I'm trying to teach her, and I hope that she's more than willing, because Mary, God bless her, is willing, but sure that's no use. It's less than no use. I'm hoping that she's quick and sharp and dependable, but nowadays you can't get that for love or money."
Eilish looked at Mary, who was standing uneasily near the cash register, listening carefully.
"But the Lord makes all types," Miss Kelly said.
"Oh, you're right there, Miss Kelly," the woman with the perm said as she filled her string bag with groceries. "And there's no use in complaining, is there? Sure, don't we need people to sweep the streets?"
On Saturday, with money borrowed from her mother, Eilish bought a dark green shop coat in Dan Bolger's. That night she asked her mother for the alarm clock. She would have to be up by 6 o'clock in the morning. Since Jack, the nearest to her in age, had followed his two older brothers, Pat and Martin, to Birmingham to find work, Eilish had moved into the boys' room, leaving Rose her own bedroom, which their mother carefully tidied and cleaned each morning. As their mother's pension was small, they depended on Rose, who worked in the office of Davis's Mills. Her wages paid for most of their needs. Anything extra came sporadically from the boys in England. Twice a year, Rose went to Dublin for the sales, coming back each January with a new coat and costume, and each August with a new dress and new cardigans and skirts and blouses, which were often chosen because Rose did not think they would go out of fashion, and then put away until the following year. Most of Rose's friends now were married women, often older women whose children had grown up, or wives of men who worked in the banks, who had time to play golf on summer evenings, or in mixed foursomes at the weekends. Rose, at 30, Eilish thought, was more glamorous every year, and, while she had had several boyfriends, she remained single. She often remarked that she had a much better life than many of her former schoolmates, who were to be seen pushing prams through the streets. Eilish was proud of her sister, of how much care she took with her appearance, and how much care she put into whom she mixed with in the town and the golf club. She knew that Rose had tried to find her work in an office, and Rose was paying for her books now that she was studying bookkeeping and rudimentary accountancy. But she knew also that there was, at least for the moment, no work for anyone in Enniscorthy, no matter what their qualifications. Eilish did not tell Rose about her offer of work from Miss Kelly. Instead, as she went through her training, she saved up every detail to recount to her mother, who laughed and made her tell some parts of the story again. "That Miss Kelly," her mother said, "is as bad as her mother, and I heard from someone who worked there that that woman was evil incarnate. And she was just a maid in Roche's before she married. And Kelly's used to be a boarding house as well as a shop, and if you worked for her, or even if you stayed there or dealt in the shop, she was evil incarnate. Unless, of course, you had plenty of money, or were one of the clergy. I'm just there until something turns up," Eilish said. "That's what I said to Rose when I was telling her," her mother replied. "And don't listen to her if she says anything to you." Rose, however, never mentioned that Eilish was to begin work at Miss Kelly's. Instead, she gave her a pale yellow cardigan that she herself had barely worn, insisting that the color was wrong for her and that it would look better on Eilish. She also gave her some lipstick. She was out late on Saturday night, so she did not witness Eilish going to bed early, even though Nancy and Annette were going to the pictures, so that she would be fresh for work at Miss Kelly's on her first Sunday. Only once, years before, had Eilish been to 7 o'clock Mass, and that was on a Christmas morning, when her father was alive and the boys were still at home. She remembered that she and her mother had tiptoed out of the house while the others were sleeping, leaving the presents under the tree in the upstairs living room, and coming back just after the boys and Rose and their father had woken and begun to open the packages. She remembered the darkness, the cold, and the beautiful emptiness of the town. Now, leaving the house just after the 20-7 bell rang, with her shop coat in a carrier bag and her hair tied in a ponytail, she walked through the streets to the cathedral, making sure she was in plenty of time. She remembered that on that Christmas morning, years before, the seats in the central aisle of the cathedral had almost been full. Women with a long morning in the kitchen ahead of them wanted an early start, but now there was almost nobody. She looked around for Miss Kelly, but she did not see her until communion, and then realized that she had been sitting across from her all along. She watched her walking down the main aisle with her hands joined and her eyes on the ground, followed by Mary, who was wearing a black mantilla. They both must have fasted, she thought, as she had been fasting, and she wondered when they would have their breakfast. Once Mass was over, she decided not to wait for Miss Kelly in the cathedral grounds, but instead lingered at the newsstand as they unpacked bundles of newspapers, and then stood outside the shop and waited for her there. Miss Kelly did not greet her or smile when she arrived, but moved gruffly to the side door, ordering Eilish and Mary to wait outside. As she unlocked the main door of the shop and began to turn on the lights, Mary went to the back of the shop and started to carry loaves of bread towards the counter. Eilish realized that this was yesterday's bread. There was no bread delivered on a Sunday. She stood and watched as Miss Kelly opened a new strip of long, sticky yellow paper to attract flies, and told Mary to stand on the counter, fix it to the ceiling, and take down the old one, which had dead flies stuck to every part of it.
"No one likes flies," Miss Kelly said, "especially on a Sunday."
Soon, two or three people came into the shop to buy cigarettes. Even though Eilish had already put her shop coat on, Miss Kelly ordered Mary to deal with them. When they had gone, Miss Kelly told Mary to go upstairs and make a pot of tea, which she then delivered to the newspaper kiosk in exchange for what Eilish learned was a free copy of the Sunday Press, which Miss Kelly folded and put aside. Eilish noticed that neither Miss Kelly nor Mary had anything to eat or drink. Miss Kelly ushered her into a back room.
"That bread there," she said, pointing to a table, "is the freshest. It came yesterday evening all the way from Stafford's, but it is only for special customers. So you don't touch that bread, whatever you do. The other bread'll do fine for most people. And we have no tomatoes. Those ones there are not for anybody unless I give precise instructions."
After 9 o'clock Mass, the first crowd came. People who wanted cigarettes and sweets seemed to know to approach Mary. Miss Kelly stood back, her attention divided between the door and Eilish. She checked every price Eilish wrote down, informed her briskly of the price when she could not remember, and wrote down and added up the figures herself after Eilish had done so, not letting her give the customer the change until she had also been shown the original payment. As well as doing this, she greeted certain customers by name, motioning them forward and insisting that Eilish break off whatever she was doing to serve them.
"Oh, Mrs. Prendergast, now," she said. "The new girl will look after you now, and Mary will carry everything out to the car for you."
"I need to finish this first," Eilish said, as she was only a few items away from completing another order.
"Oh, Mary will do that," Miss Kelly said.
By this time, people were five deep at the counter.
"I'm next," a man shouted as Miss Kelly came back to the counter with more bread. "Now we are very busy and you will have to wait your turn." "But I was next," the man said, "and that woman was served before me. So what is it you want?"
The man had a list of groceries in his hand.
"Eilish will deal with you now," Miss Kelly said, "but only after Mrs. Murphy here."
"I was before her too,"
the man said.
"I'm afraid you are mistaken," Miss Kelly said. "Eilish, hurry up now, this man is waiting. No one has all day, so he's next, after Mrs. Murphy. What price did you charge for that tea?"
It was like this until almost 1 o'clock. There was no break and nothing to eat or drink, and Eilish was starving. No one was served in turn. Miss Kelly informed some of her customers, including two who, being friends of Rose, greeted Eilish familiarly, that she had lovely fresh tomatoes. She weighed them herself, seeming to be impressed that Eilish knew these customers, telling others firmly, however, that she had no tomatoes that day, none at all. For favored customers, she openly, almost proudly, produced the fresh bread. The problem was, Eilish realized, that there was no other shop in the town that was as well stocked as Miss Kelly's and open on a Sunday morning. But she also had a sense that people came here out of habit, and they did not mind waiting. They enjoyed the crush and the crowd. Although she had planned not to mention her new job and Miss Kelly's over dinner at home that day, unless Rose raised the matter first, Eilish could not contain herself and began as soon as they sat down to describe her morning.
"I went into that shop once," Rose said, "on my way home from Mass, and she served Mary Delahunt before me. I turned and walked out, and there was a smell of something. I can't think what it was. She has a little slave, doesn't she? She took her out of a convent."
"Her father was a nice enough man," her mother said, "but she had no chance because her mother was, as I told you, Eilish, evil incarnate. I heard that when one of the maids got scolded, she wouldn't even let her go to the doctor. The mother had Nelly working there from the time she could walk. She's never seen daylight, that's what's wrong with her."
"Nelly Kelly?" Rose asked. "Is that really her name?"
"In school they had a different name for her."
"What was it?"
"Everyone called her Nettles Kelly. The nuns couldn't stop us. I remember her well. She was a year or two behind me. She'd always have five or six girls following behind her coming from the Mercy Convent shouting, 'Nettles!' No wonder she's so mad."
There was a silence for a while as Rose and Eilish took this in.
"You wouldn't know whether to laugh or cry," Rose said.
Eilish found, as the meal went on, that she could do an imitation of Miss Kelly's voice that made her sister and her mother laugh. She wondered if she was the only one who remembered that Jack, the youngest of her brothers, used to do imitations of the Sunday sermon, the radio sports commentators, the teachers at school, and many characters in the town, and they all used to laugh. She did not know if the other two also realized that this was the first time they had laughed at this table since Jack had followed the others to Birmingham. She would have loved to say something about him, but she knew that it would make her mother too sad. Even when a letter came from him, it was passed around in silence. So she continued mocking Miss Kelly, stopping only when someone called for Rose to take her to play golf, leaving Eilish and her mother to clear the table and wash the dishes. That evening, Eilish called at Nancy Burns at 9, aware that she had not made enough effort with her appearance. She had washed her hair and put on a summer dress, but she thought that she looked dowdy and was resigned to the idea that if Nancy danced more than one dance with George Sheridan, then she was going home on her own. She was glad that Rose had not seen her before she left, as she would have made her do something more with her hair and put on some makeup and generally try to look smarter. "Now the rule is," Nancy said, "that we are not even looking at George Sheridan, and he might be with a whole crowd from the rugby club, or he might not even be there at all. They often go to Corktown on a Sunday night, that crowd. So we are to be deep in conversation, and I'm not dancing with anyone else, just in case he came and saw me. So if someone is coming over to ask us to dance, we just stand up and go to the ladies." It was clear that Nancy, using help from her sister and mother, with both of whom she finally shared the news that she had danced with George Sheridan the previous Sunday, had gone to a great deal of trouble. She had had her hair done the day before. She was wearing a blue dress that Eilish had seen only once before, and she was now applying makeup in front of the bathroom mirror as her mother and sister made their way in and out of the room, offering advice and commentary and admiration. They walked in silence from Frary Street into Church Street, and then around to Castle Street, and into the Athenaeum, and up the stairs to the hall. Eilish was not surprised at how nervous Nancy was. It was a year since her boyfriend had let her down badly by turning up one night with another girl in this very same hall, and staying with the other girl all night, barely acknowledging Nancy's existence as she sat watching. Later he had gone to England, coming home briefly only to get married to the girl he had been with that night. It was not just that George Sheridan was handsome and had a car, but he ran a shop that did a thriving business in the market square. It was a business he would inherit in full on his mother's death. For Nancy, who worked in Buttle's barley-fed bacon behind the counter, going out with George Sheridan was a dream that she did not wish to wake from, Eilish thought, as she and Nancy glanced around the hall, pretending they were not on the lookout for anyone in particular. There were some couples dancing, and a few men standing near the door. "They look like they're at a cattle mart," Nancy said, "and God, it's the hair oil I hate." "If one of them comes over, I'll stand up immediately," Eilish said, "and you tell them that you have to go with me to the cloakroom." "We should have bottle glasses and buck teeth and have left our hair all greasy," Nancy said. As the place filled up, there was no sign of George Sheridan, and even as men crossed the hall to ask women to dance, no one approached either Nancy or Eilish. "We'll get a name for being wallflowers," Nancy said. "You could be called worse," Eilish said. "Oh, you could. It could be called the Courtnacuddy Bus," Nancy replied. Even when they had both stopped laughing and had gone back to looking around the hall, one of them would begin giggling again and it would start the other one off too. "We must look mad," Eilish said. Nancy beside her, however, had suddenly become serious. As Eilish looked over at the bar where soft drinks were on sale, she saw that George Sheridan, Jim Farrell, and a number of their friends from the rugby club had arrived, and there were a number of young women with them. Jim Farrell's father owned a pub in Rafter Street. "That's it," Nancy whispered. "I'm going home."
"Wait, don't do that," Eilish said. "We'll go to the ladies at the end of this set and then discuss what to do."
They waited and crossed the floor, empty of dancers. Eilish presumed that George Sheridan had spotted them. In the ladies, she told Nancy to do nothing, just to wait, and they would go back out when the next dance was in full swing. As they did so, and Eilish glanced over to where George and his friends had been, she caught George's eye. Nancy's face, as they searched for somewhere to sit, had turned a blotched red. She looked like someone whom the nuns had told to go and stand outside the door. They sat there without speaking as the dance went on. Everything Eilish thought of saying was ridiculous, and so she said nothing, but she was aware that they both must seem a sad sight to anyone who paid any attention to them. She decided that if Nancy made even the weakest suggestion that they should go after this set, then she would agree immediately. Indeed, she longed to be outside already. She knew they would find some way of making a laugh of it later. At the end of the set, however, George walked across the hall even before the music began and asked Nancy to dance. He smiled at Eilish as Nancy stood up, and she smiled at him in return. As they began to dance, with George chatting easily, Nancy seemed to be making an effort to look cheerful. Eilish looked away in case her watching made Nancy uncomfortable, and then looked at the ground, hoping that no one would ask her to dance. It would be easier now, she thought, if George asked Nancy for the next dance when this set was over and she could slip quietly home. Instead, George and Nancy came towards her and said they were going to get a lemonade at the bar, and George would like to buy one for Eilish as well. She stood up and walked across the hall with them. Jim Farrell was standing at the bar holding a place for George. Some of their other friends, one or two of whom Eilish knew by name and the others by sight, were close by. As they approached, Jim Farrell turned and kept an elbow on the counter. He looked both Nancy and Eilish up and down without nodding or speaking, and then moved over and said something to George. As the music began again, some of their friends took to the floor, but Jim Farrell did not move. As George handed the glasses full of lemonade to Nancy and Eilish, he set about introducing them formally to Jim Farrell, who nodded curtly but did not shake hands. George seemed at a loss as he stood sipping his drink. He said something to Nancy, and she replied. Then he sipped his drink again. Eilish wondered what he was going to do. It was clear that his friend did not like Nancy or Eilish and had no intention of speaking to them. Eilish wished she had not been brought to the bar like this. She sipped her drink and looked at the ground. When she glanced up, she saw Jim Farrell studying Nancy coldly, and then, when he noticed he was being watched by Eilish, he shifted his ground and looked at her, his face expressionless. He was wearing, she saw, an expensive sports jacket and a shirt with a cravat. George put the glass on the counter and turned to Nancy, inviting her to dance. He motioned to Jim, as if to suggest that he should do the same. Nancy smiled at George, and then at Eilish and Jim, left her drink down, and went to the dance floor with him. She seemed relieved and happy. As Eilish looked around, she was aware that she and Jim Farrell were alone at the bar counter, and that there was no room at the ladies' side of the hall. Unless she went to the ladies again, or went home, she was trapped. For a second, Jim Farrell looked as though he was stepping forward to ask her to dance. Eilish, since she felt she had no choice, was ready to accept. She did not want to be rude to George's friend. Just as she was about to accept him, Jim Farrell appeared to think better of it, stepped back, and almost imperiously glanced around the hall, ignoring her. He did not look at her again, and when the set was over, she went and found Nancy and told her quietly that she was leaving and would see her soon. She shook hands with George and made the excuse that she was tired, and then walked from the hall with as much dignity as she could. The following evening at tea, she told her mother and Rose the story. They were interested at first in the news that Nancy had been dancing two Sunday nights in succession with George Sheridan, but they became far more animated when Eilish told them about the rudeness of Jim Farrell. "Don't go near that Anthonyum again," Rose said. "Your father knew his father well," her mother said, "years ago. They went to the races together a few times. And your father drank in Farrell's sometimes. It's very well kept. And his mother is a very nice woman. She was a Dugan from Glenbryan. It must be the rugby club has him that way. And it must be sad for his parents having a pup for a son, because he's an only child." "He sounds like a pup all right, and he looks like one," Rose said. "Well, he was in a bad mood last night anyway," Eilish said. "That's all I have to say. I suppose he might think that George should be with someone grander than Nancy." "There's no excuse for that," her mother said. "Nancy Byrne is one of the most beautiful girls in this town. George would be very lucky to get her." "I wonder would his mother agree," Rose said. "Some of the shopkeepers in this town," her mother said,
especially the ones who buy cheap and sell dear. All they have is a few yards of counter, and they have to sit there all day waiting for customers. I don't know why they think so highly of themselves.
Although Miss Kelly paid Eilish only 7 and 6 pence a week for working on Sundays, she often sent Mary to fetch her at other times. Once when she wanted to get her hair done without closing the shop, and once when she wanted all the tins on the shelves taken down and dusted and then replaced. Each time she gave Eilish 2 shillings, but kept her for hours, complaining about Mary whenever she could. Each time also, as she left, Miss Kelly handed Eilish a loaf of bread, which Eilish knew was stale, to give to her mother.
"She must think we're paupers," her mother said. "What would we do with stale bread? Rose will go mad. Don't go there the next time she sends for you. Tell her you're busy."
"But I'm not busy. A proper job will turn up. That's what I'm praying for every day."
Her mother made breadcrumbs with the stale bread and roasted stuffed pork. She did not tell Rose where the breadcrumbs came from. One day at dinner time, Rose, who walked home from the office at 1 and returned at 1:45, mentioned that she had played golf the previous evening with a priest, a Father Flood, who had known their father years before and their mother when she was a young girl. He was home from America on holidays, his first visit since before the war.
"Flood?" her mother asked. "There was a crowd of Floods out near Monaghan, but I don't remember any of them becoming a priest. I don't know what became of them. You never see any of them now."
"There's Murphy Floods," Eilish said.
"That's not the same," her mother replied.
"Anyway," Rose said, "I invited him in for his tea when he said that he'd like to call on you, and he's coming tomorrow."
"Oh, God," her mother said. "What would an American priest like for his tea? I'll have to get cooked ham."
"Miss Kelly has the best cooked ham," Eilish said, laughing. "No one is buying anything from Miss Kelly," Rose replied. "Father Flood will eat whatever we give him."
"Would cooked ham be all right with tomatoes and lettuce? Or maybe roast beef? Or would he like a fry?"
"Anything will be fine," Rose said, "with plenty of brown bread and butter.
We'll have it in the dining room, and we'll use the good china. If I could get a bit of salmon, maybe, would he eat that?"
"He's very nice," Rose said. "He'll eat anything you put in front of him."
Father Flood was tall. His accent was a mixture of Irish and American. Nothing he said could convince Eilish's mother that she had known him or his family. His mother, he said, had been a Rockford.
"I don't think I knew her," her mother said.
"The only Rockford we knew was old Hatchethead."
Father Flood looked at her solemnly.
"Hatchethead was my uncle," he said.
"Was he?"
her mother asked. Eilish saw how close she was to nervous laughter. "But of course we didn't call him that," Father Flood said. "His real name was Seamus."
"Well, he was very nice," her mother said. "Weren't we awful to call him that?"
Rose poured more tea as Eilish quietly left the room, afraid that if she stayed she would be unable to disguise an urge to begin laughing. When she returned, she realized that Father Flood had heard about her job at Miss Kelly's, had found out about her pay, and had expressed shock at how low it was. He inquired about her qualifications.
"In the United States," he said, "there would be plenty of work for someone like you, and with good pay."
"She thought of going to England," her mother said, "but the boys said to wait, that it wasn't the best time there, and she might only get factory work."
"In Brooklyn, where my parish is, there would be office work for someone who was hard-working and educated and honest."
"It's very far away, though," her mother said. "That's the only thing."
"Parts of Brooklyn," Father Flood replied, "are just like Ireland. They're full of Irish."
He crossed his legs and sipped his tea from the china cup and said nothing for a while. The silence that descended made it clear to Eilish what the others were thinking. She looked across at her mother, who deliberately, it seemed to her, did not return her glance, but kept her gaze fixed on the floor. Rose, normally so good at moving the conversation along if they had a visitor, also said nothing. She twisted her ring and then her bracelet.
"It would be a great opportunity, especially if you were young," Father Flood said finally.
"It might be very dangerous,"
her mother said, her eyes still fixed on the floor. Not in my parish, Father Flood said. It's full of lovely people. A lot of life centers around the parish, even more than in Ireland. And there's work for anyone who's willing to work. Eilish felt like a child when the doctor would come to the house, her mother listening with cowed respect. It was Rose's silence that was new to her. She looked at her now, wanting her sister to ask a question or make a comment, but Rose appeared to be in a sort of dream. As Eilish watched her, it struck her that she had never seen Rose look so beautiful. And then it occurred to her that she was already feeling that she would need to remember this room, her sister, this scene, as though from a distance. In the silence that had lingered, she realized it had somehow been tacitly arranged that Eilish would go to America. Father Flood, she believed, had been invited to the house because Rose knew that he could arrange it. Her mother had been so opposed to her going to England that this new realization came to Eilish as a shock. She wondered if she had not taken the job in the shop and had not told them about her weekly humiliation at Miss Kelly's hands, might they have been so ready to let this conversation happen? She regretted having told them so much. She had done so mostly because it had made Rose and her mother laugh, brightened a number of meals they had had with each other, made eating together nicer and easier than any time since her father had died and the boys had left. It now occurred to her that her mother and Rose did not think her working for Miss Kelly was funny at all, and they offered no word of demurral as Father Flood moved from praising his parish in Brooklyn to saying that he believed he would be able to find Eilish a suitable position there. In the days that followed, no mention was made of Father Flood's visit or his raising the possibility of her going to Brooklyn, and it was the silence itself that led Eilish to believe that Rose and her mother had discussed it and were in favor of it. She had never considered going to America. Many she knew had gone to England and often came back at Christmas or in the summer. It was part of the life of the town. Although she knew friends who regularly received presents of dollars or clothes from America, it was always from their aunts and uncles, people who had emigrated long before the war. She could not remember any of these people ever appearing in the town on holidays. It was a long journey across the Atlantic, she knew, at least a week on a ship, and it must be expensive. She had a sense, too, she did not know from where, that while the boys and girls from the town who had gone to England did ordinary work for ordinary money, people who went to America could become rich. She tried to work out how she had come to believe also that, while people from the town who lived in England missed Enniscorthy, no one who went to America missed home. Instead, they were happy there and proud. She wondered if that could be true. Father Flood did not visit again. Instead, he wrote a letter to her mother when he returned to Brooklyn, saying that he had spoken, soon after he arrived, to one of his parishioners, a merchant of Italian origin, about Eilish, and wanted to let Mrs. Lacey know that there would soon be a position vacant. It would not be in the office, as he had hoped, but on the shop floor of the large store that this gentleman owned and managed. But, he added, he had been assured that, were Eilish to prove satisfactory in her first job, there would be plenty of opportunity for promotion and very good prospects. He would also, he said, be able to provide suitable documentation to satisfy the embassy, which was often not so easy nowadays, and would, he was sure, be able to find suitable accommodation for Eilish near the church and not far from her place of work. Her mother handed her the letter when she had it read. Rose had already gone to work. There was silence in the kitchen. "He seems very genuine," her mother said. "I'll say that for him." Eilish read the sentence again about the shop floor. She presumed that he meant she would work behind a counter. Father Flood did not mention how much she would earn or how she would raise the money to pay the fare. Instead, he suggested that she should get in touch with the American Embassy in Dublin and ascertain precisely what documents she would require before she traveled so they could all be arranged. As she read and reread, her mother moved about the kitchen with her back to her, saying nothing. Eilish sat at the table, not speaking either, wondering how long it would take her mother to turn towards her and say something, deciding that she would sit and wait, counting each second, knowing that her mother had no real work to do. She was, in fact, Eilish saw, making work for herself so that she would not have to turn. Finally, her mother turned
and sighed. "Keep that letter safe now," she said, "and we'll show it to Rose when she comes in." Within weeks, Rose had organized everything, even managing to befriend by telephone a figure in the American Embassy in Dublin who sent the necessary forms and a list of doctors authorized to write a report on Eilish's general health and a list of other things the embassy would require, including a precise offer of work, work that Eilish was singularly qualified to do, a guarantee that she would be looked after financially on her arrival, and a number of character references. Father Flood wrote a formal letter sponsoring Eilish and guaranteeing to take care of her accommodation as well as her general and financial welfare, and on headed notepaper came a letter from Bartocci and Company, Fulton Street, Brooklyn, offering her a permanent position in their main store at the same address and mentioning her bookkeeping skills and general experience. It was signed Laura Fortini. The handwriting, Eilish noted, was clear and beautiful, and even the notepaper itself, its light blue color, the embossed drawing of a large building over the letterhead, seemed heavier, more expensive, more promising than anything of its kind she had seen before. It was agreed that her brothers in Birmingham would, between them, pay her passage to New York. Rose would give her money to live on until she was settled in her job. She told the news to a few friends, asking them not to tell anyone else, but Eilish knew that some of Rose's colleagues at work had heard the phone calls to Dublin. She was aware also that her mother would not be able to keep the news to herself. Thus, she felt that she should go and tell Miss Kelly before she heard it from someone else. It was best, she thought, to go during the week, when things were not so busy. She found Miss Kelly standing behind the counter. Mary was at the top of a ladder stacking packets of marrow-fat peas on the higher shelves. "Oh, you've come at the worst time now," Miss Kelly said, "just when we thought we would have a bit of peace. Now don't disturb that Mary one, whatever you do." She inclined her head in the direction of the ladder. "She'd fall as soon as she'd look at you." "Well, I just came to say that I'll be going to America in about a month's time," Eilish said. "I'm going to work there, and I wanted to give you plenty of notice." Miss Kelly stood back from the counter. "Is that right?" she asked. "But I'll be here on Sundays, of course, until I go."
"Is it a reference you're looking for?"
"No, not at all. I just came to let you know."
"Well, that's lovely now. So we'll see you when you come home on holidays, if you'll still be talking to everyone."
"I'll be here on Sunday," Eilish said.
"Ah, no, we won't be needing you at all. If you're going, you're best to go."
"But I could come."
"No, you couldn't. There'd be too much talk about you, and there'd be too much distraction, and we're very busy on a Sunday, as you know, without that."
"I was hoping I could work until I left."
"Not here, you can't. So be off with you now. We have plenty of work, more deliveries today and more stacking, and no time for talking."
"Well, thank you very much."
"And thank you, too."
As Miss Kelly moved towards the store at the back of the shop, Eilish looked to see if Mary would turn so she could say goodbye to her. Since Mary did not, Eilish quietly left the shop and went home. Miss Kelly was the only one who mentioned the possibility of her coming home on holidays. No one else mentioned it. Until now, Eilish had always presumed that she would live in the town all her life, as her mother had done, knowing everyone, having the same friends and neighbors, the same routines and the same streets. She had expected that she would find a job in the town, and then marry someone and give up the job and have children. Now she felt that she was being singled out for something for which she was not in any way prepared, and this, despite the fear it carried with it, gave her a feeling, or more a set of feelings, she thought she might experience in the days before her wedding, days in which everyone looked at her in the rush of arrangements with light in their eyes, days in which she herself was fizzy with excitement, but careful not to think too precisely about what the next few weeks would be like in case she lost her nerve. There was no day that passed without an event. The forms that came from the embassy were filled in and sent back. She went on the train to Wexford Town for what seemed to her a cursory medical examination, the doctor appearing to be satisfied when she told him that no one in her family had suffered from tuberculosis. Father Flood wrote with more details of where she would stay when she arrived and how close it would be to her place of work. Her ticket arrived for the ship to New York, which would leave from Liverpool. Rose gave her some money for clothes and promised to buy her shoes and a complete set of underwear. The house was, she thought, unusually, almost unnaturally happy, and the meals they shared were full of too much talk and laughter. It reminded her of the weeks before Jack had left for Birmingham, when they would do anything to distract themselves from the thought that they were losing him. One day, when a neighbor called and sat in the kitchen with them having tea, Eilish realized that her mother and Rose were doing everything to hide their feelings. The neighbor, almost casually, as a way of making conversation, said, "You'll miss her when she's gone, I'd say." "Oh, it'll kill me when she goes," her mother said. Her face wore a dark, strained look that Eilish had not seen since the months after their father died. Then, in the moments that followed, the neighbor appearing to have been taken aback by her mother's tone, her mother's expression became almost darker, and she had to stand up and quietly walk out of the room. It was clear to Eilish that she was going to cry. Eilish was so surprised that, instead of following her mother into the hallway or the dining room, she made small talk with their neighbor, hoping her mother would soon return and they could resume what had seemed like an ordinary conversation. Even when she woke in the night and thought about it, she did not allow herself to conclude that she did not want to go. Instead, she went over all the arrangements and worried about carrying two suitcases with all her clothes without any help, and making sure that she did not lose the handbag that Rose had given her, where she would keep her passport and the addresses in Brooklyn where she would live and work, and Father Flood's address in case he did not turn up to meet her as he had promised to do, and money, and her makeup bag, and an overcoat maybe to be carried over her arm, although perhaps she would wear it, she thought, unless it was too hot. And it still might be hot in late September, she had been warned. She had already packed one case and hoped, as she went over its contents in her mind, that she would not have to open it again. It struck her on one of those nights as she lay awake that the next time she would open that suitcase would be in a different room in a different country, and then the thought came unbidden into her mind that she would be happier if it were opened by another person who could keep the clothes and shoes and wear them every day. She would prefer to stay at home, sleep in this room, live in this house, do without the clothes and shoes. The arrangements being made, all the bustle and talk, would be better if they were for someone else, she thought. Someone like her, someone the same age and size, who maybe even looked the same as she did. As long as she, the person who was thinking now, could wake in this bed every morning and move as the day went on in these familiar streets and come home to the kitchen, to her mother and Rose. Even though she let these thoughts run as fast as they would, she still stopped when her mind moved towards real fear or dread or, worse, towards the thought that she was going to lose this world forever, that she would never have an ordinary day again in this ordinary place, that the rest of her life would be a struggle with the unfamiliar. Downstairs, once Rose and her mother were there, she talked about practical things and remained bright. One evening, when Rose invited her into her room so that she could choose some pieces of jewelry to bring with her, something new occurred to Eilish that surprised her by its force and clarity. Rose was 30 now, and since it was obvious that their mother could never be left to live alone, not merely because her pension was small, but because she would be too lonely without any of them, Eilish's going, which Rose had organized so precisely, would mean that Rose would not be able to marry. She would have to stay with their mother, living as she was now, working in Davis's office, playing golf at the weekends and on summer evenings. Rose, she realized, in making it easy for her to go, was giving up any real prospect of leaving this house herself and having her own house with her own family. Eilish, as she fitted on some necklaces, seated in front of her dressing table mirror, saw that in the future, as her mother got older and more frail, Rose would have to care for her even more, go up the steep steps of the stairs with trays of food and do the cleaning and cooking when her mother could not. It occurred to her also, as she tried on some earrings, that Rose knew all this too, knew that either she or Eilish would have to leave, and had decided to let Eilish go. As she turned and looked at her sister, Eilish wanted to suggest that they change places, that Rose, so ready for life, always making new friends, would be happier going to America, just as Eilish would be quite content to stay at home. But Rose had a job in the town, and she did not. And so it was easy for Rose to sacrifice herself, since it seemed that she was doing something else. In these moments, as Rose offered her some brooches to take with her, Eilish would have given anything to be able to say plainly that she did not want to go, that Rose could go instead, that she would happily stay here and take care of her mother, and they would manage somehow, and maybe she would find other work. She wondered if her mother, too, believed that the wrong sister was leaving, and understood what Rose's motives were. She imagined that her mother knew everything. They knew so much, each one of them, she thought, that they could do everything except say out loud what it was they were thinking. She resolved that as she went back to her room, that she would do everything she could for them by pretending at all times that she was filled with excitement at the great adventure on which she was ready to embark. She would make them believe, if she could, that she was looking forward to America and leaving home for the first time. She promised herself that not for one moment would she give them the smallest hint of how she felt, and she would keep it from herself, if she had to, until she was away from them. There was, she thought, enough sadness in the house, maybe even more than she realized. She would try as best she could not to add to it. Her mother and Rose could not be fooled, she was sure, but there seemed to her an even greater reason why there should be no tears before her departure. They would not be needed. What she would need to do in the days before she left and on the morning of her departure was smile, so that they would remember her smiling. Rose took the day off from work and traveled with her to Dublin. They went to lunch together in the Gresham Hotel before it was time for the taxi to the boat to Liverpool, where Jack had agreed to meet her and spend the day with her before she set out on her long journey to New York. That day in Dublin, Eilish was aware that going to work in America was different from just taking the boat to England. America might be further away and so utterly foreign in its systems and its manners, yet it had an almost compensating glamour attached to it. Even going to work in a shop in Brooklyn with lodgings a few streets away, all organized by a priest, had an element of romance that she and Rose were fully alert to as they ordered their lunch in the Gresham, having left her luggage in the railway station. Going to work in a shop in Birmingham or Liverpool or Coventry or even London was